Welcome to the National Institute for Gamer Review. I am DK.
I am Lewis, and I think we have a format finally, right? So, you know, we happened upon this format, which I think is fun. Which
it was waiting there for us. It was sort of low-hanging fruit of like, well,
you know, video games to filter all the geopolitics junkies, so you don't, you know,
right?
So and then
serious
and then
guys
the geopolitics at the end.
Who wears suits?
Yeah. We don't like that. We don't want people who are serious. We want to filter you with video games, and then jukebox at the end.
Yes, to filter the autists in the basement. Yes. That's none of our fans, of course. We only have the highest class listeners, evidenced by our many great comments. People were asking about the email address again. It's niggertalk NIGRTALK.
Yes.
ProtonMail.
Proton.me. Proton.me.
Proton.me. Okay.
Yes.
Yeah, so please keep we're still working on our next mailbag, but as always we get incisive comments. So yeah, you wanted to do this cuz you wanted to talk about video games. So what have you been playing?
I have been playing a lot of games with Game Pass. I go through phases of like just getting real into my Netflix video games thing. And I played some good stuff and some bad stuff. And one thing I think will be near and dear to your heart is that I want to discuss my...
Sorry.
No, I need to. That one and like the other...
Apparently
they're
shutting down,
like...
or they're moving to... They're, I don't know.
Oh, shit. Oh, no. God, I'll miss the chance.
I know, right?
There's another game that's like, it's called like... I don't know, it's some like shooter, but you're a wizard. I don't know, whatever. That sounded terrible, but like it really flopped really hard, but now it's on Game Pass for free. Apparently it's...
You mean like Hexen
rough.
Back in the day?
Yeah, like there's a it's basically like the reviews that I saw were like, oh, it's a game, it's a shoot, it's not a shooter, it's a fantasy game, but like there's a spell that's an assault rifle, a spell that's a shotgun, a spell that's an SMG, a spell that's a sniper rifle.
I saw something about this, yes, and it was sort of like, why? It sort of just completely removes
the really
reason.
Not really exploring the medium here. Yeah. And I think the Harry Potter shit did it better too, in a lot of ways.
I never played the new Harry Potter Dark Souls, but I heard it was actually pretty good.
Neither did I, but I saw like what I watched of that team. Oh, they're doing a wizard game, and that of course them coming out around the same time frame. Like one being a recognizable property, doing a better wizard experience, like stomped the other one. Happens, you know.
Well, it's also but I don't want to... Harry Potter IP. Yeah. Yeah, sorry, you don't want to talk about games you didn't play. I understand.
Yeah, but I do want to talk about games I did play, which is. This saga of me attempt... Well, okay. I say thing didn't play. I did play. I enjoyed the trying to get Diablo 4 to launch on a console experience, which ends with me not being able
to
actually get it going.
Launch? So it was, like, unstable, or what?
No. It was, like... Okay, so when you start... So I have it... It's free on Game Pass now, because it's a flop. Basically, I get access to all the flops.
That was my next question, was I didn't realize Diablo 4 was on Game Pass.
Yeah.
That's quite an admission.
Any game that flops gets its Xbox port.
But, I mean, Diablo 4, that's like, well, whatever, we could talk. I assume that's why you're even bringing it up, is, wow, what a fall from grace for Blizzard. But anyway, continue.
Well, I imagine also, like, they want to lock you into their, like, microtransactions and stuff. That's why they're okay with giving it for free, like on a lower threshold, because it's a microtransactions game.
Maybe, I mean, are people...
But
I guess I
don't know that, because I downloaded the video game. Alright. I go to launch the video game. I log into my, you know, Xbox Live account, which is my account. It has all the DRM associated with me and my credit card, all these wonderful things. I start a game. It says, oh... You need to make a Blizzard account BattleNet. And I'm like, okay,
sure. Gonna say, I did that.
I hit
the
effect, one,
I made a BioWare account for back when they had their own, like, BioWare. For those who remember, BioWare used to have their own, like, separate game currency apart from Xbox credits or whatever that you had. I guess they could be equivalent, but... anyway, yeah. So I did that. I could see myself doing that for Diablo.
Yeah,
if
it's really easy
to just doing an email verification. Yeah.
Yeah. You would think, right?
You would think.
Okay, so you would think that when you start up this account, you gotta get a BattleNet. But no, it creates, it pops up the in-firmware hard-coded Microsoft Edge onboard the console browser on the internet.
Oh my god.
And using this and to the create account is a hell I don't wish on anyone. Trying to type in using the cursor, using like the pop-up keyboard, it's truly miserable.
And you did it
and
okay?
I do it
okay.
I did it, and then it failed for some reason I couldn't ascertain.
Oh,
right,
man.
And it's like, this didn't work probably because you're using like Edge whatever,
yeah, like 0 point, like
yeah,
or whatever, yeah.
Firmware hard code only like just running on a different OS, right, whatever the native, yeah, Xbox OS is. That's not Windows, but it kind of is, but it's weird enough to cause problems. Anyway, so it's like, hey, take this code and create one on, you know, just your mobile phone. That's easier. It's not. It's just as painful, right? But
unbelievable.
I do this, and it's like,
a
oh, actually...
to the bit. Wow. Okay, I would
have... You have a... No, I give up soon. So I do it, and I'm informed, oh, no, this email address already has... a Blizzard, because I'm sure I play a Blizzard game
right,
on
at
my
some point, yeah.
At some point, and I'm like, holy no! Like, I'm not doing this again.
Yeah,
and I then try to like reset the password of my Battle.net account, and because of like hackers and gold farmers and all kind of like. Chicanery that goes on the WoW servers, it has like pretty tight and obnoxious levels of security, which make that enough of a pain in the ass to make me just not gonna do it. It's rough.
Yeah, that's ridiculous.
I have a console game on a console. I should be able to. That's the whole point of the fucking console, is that I can just play video games, right? Like, I don't need to...
Yeah, at that point, it's literally just a worse PC with extra steps. There's no, like... Incredible. Wow. And I was just thinking, you know, Blizzard... I have very fond memories of... we've never done a Warcraft episode, and I know Mike has talked about Warcraft 2 in the past, and I think we'll have to get him on at some point. The thought that the company that Blizzard, the company that made Warcraft and Starcraft, and that they can't even fucking manage to, and Diablo for that matter. I mean, the original Diablo. Now, as I understand it, the original Diablo was something of a the developer. Essentially, Blizzard acted mostly as just a publisher. However, I believe that was not the case for Diablo 2, which obviously remains. The high point of the series. And yeah, I have to say, I was only moderately tempted to pick up Diablo 4 and haven't and won't. The art direction looks mostly pretty cool, certainly better than 3. But it just seems kind of like it's attained this weird singularity, maybe, of like, when the first Diablo came out and Diablo 2 was pretty, I mean, by modern game development lifecycle standards, it was like 3 or 4 years later, it was very fast. And this was, I think, true of both of them. There was no such thing as like a looter shooter genre or anything of the sort. It was, yes, okay, there was like, when enemies were kind of like pinatas of a sort, but it was sort of an abstraction and a condensation of the violent and tactically interesting parts of Dungeons and Dragons, which was also like, I mean, there was a great 4chan text, I think a while back or something like that, where people, or maybe a Twitter thread, where some people were saying like, yeah, you know, the original Dungeons and Dragons was basically you and your friends go and you simulate ish trying to get treasure. And like, yes, the treasure is in some sense a motivation or a reward, but really it's about like, you know, going down in this dungeon and doing a bunch of shit. And yes, okay, there's this treasure at the end. But it's not like, I don't know, versus this kind of very story-oriented approach that D&D became, especially in the second and subsequent generations. And I think you see a lot of that dynamic in Diablo, and especially in the early Diablos, and the action RPG in its origins was kind of just abstracting that aspect of it, but it wasn't like, I don't know, the way people talk about it now, and I see this also with like Destiny and Borderlands, which I guess was the first to translate that into a first-person shooter type thing, but where like the loot pinata goes kind of out of control and marginally better, you know, like fractions of a percentage point more DPS or what, you know, regeneration of some whatever becomes like this weird Skinner box or something that I just never understood the appeal of.
Yeah, I enjoy Borderlands a lot. Speaking of, a listener actually bought me Borderlands 3 to play, and I did. I have played it. We need to like deep dive on it. Maybe we'll get him on. Because it does, there's like some wild Jew shit at the end, dude. Like,
I actually never played any of the Borderlands 1 looked interesting, and I like cell shaded animation. Yeah. So yeah, we could definitely do a Borderlands episode, and yeah, especially if there's an Indismitic hoop. But I think you understand what I'm saying, right?
Yeah, yeah,
and
for sure. Also, Blizzard is in a weird space that so most games, what happened is they lost like the leadership.
Yeah, like that was where I was going with this. No, there's none of the personnel there.
So this is where let me hit you with something that's gonna fuck you up. That's not what happened to Blizzard. Traditionally, the doctors left BioWare.
Yeah.
Cliffy left. Whatever. Who makes Gears? Fuck. Whoever made Gears.
Gearbox.
Somebody else now, right? Now it's like an in-house thing. But Microsoft basically I think has it now. Same way they'd have Halo now. Obviously, Bungie is like
Bungie
totally went
is
off Halo.
Great example of this.
Yeah. Life. But so Blizzard still has the original guys in a lot of respects. This is why. So as they expanded, they initially brought in like good people, right? Like a lot of, because they expanded relatively early and like the before DEI or any of your pick your poison
thing.
Well,
and there's thing. Go on.
Let me get this out.
Yeah,
this is a cohesive narrative that I think is very important.
Please,
to get out.
I won't interrupt.
So those guys in Blizzard had a culture of like pretty brutal, like it was relatively small teams, what they were doing at the time. As they were expanding, they were doing just crazy crunch, 120 hour weeks, that kind of stuff. Very brutal stuff. That was the culture of the company, right? And they brought in a lot of really good guys behind them, just normal white guys and Asians or whatever, you know, just to do the job, who were willing to work hard. And they didn't, they expected this of these guys. They paid them well, but they didn't treat them particularly well for industry. A lot of these guys were actually like kids of the original Blizzard guys or relatives. Like they, it was, in theory, they could have created this super cool in-house thing, but like they kept the hammer down so hard constantly. These guys would be getting, all bits got poached by other developers who weren't as basically abusive of like expectations of hours, right? So they created this really good like second generation internal thing, and those guys all ended up getting poached, or a lot of like the indie dev renaissance of like 2010 to the current day was a lot of these guys went indie too, like because Blizzard couldn't pay them to match the insane hours they were working, couldn't stop putting the hammer down. So now Blizzard's in this weird spot where they don't have a middle, right? Like, they have a lot of the original teams and founders and earlys are still there as leads, and they're trying to, like, you know, create a structure with no, like, team leads, right? They have, like, department heads, but no team leads. And they're trying to create things, and then they, I don't know how bad the crunch is anymore, if they try to fix that, but apparently they don't have a middle, like, the successor class is gutted, and now, of course, they're trying to replace that in, like, DEI time periods, right? Of course, you create this clusterfuck, right? And, of course, some of the old people have begun to left, because now they've just gotten old, right? Like, now they're all, like, in their 50s, because they Blizzard's been around so long, so they're in the weird spot where they don't, Blizzard can't develop games anymore. It's just kind of over. I think the last game you got that had like that old whatever was probably Diablo 3. But now it's like, I don't think you're going to get any more like really, really good Blizzard products
I never really played Overwatch, but I could understand the appeal. I'm old enough to remember when Overwatch was essentially what remained after the cancellation of the follow-up to World of Warcraft that never materialized. I believe it was called Titan. And some of the, anyway, like the, it wasn't immediately obvious to me that it was over. It hasn't been for a while, but yeah, I think it with the, I would put pretty much in the same spot BioWare and Blizzard at this point in terms of being structurally incapable of, of making any games. It's really sad. I was going to say earlier, and to tie into this, there's a pretty fun based Asian account on Twitter, Grums. I'm sure many people listening know who he is. He's I don't know, some kind of former Grumz is one of the former leads on World of Warcraft who eventually, like, he picked up his shit and walked out. As I understand it, or at least as I recall him telling the story, essentially over like DEI type stuff, but like way before it was cool, in like the very early 2010s or something like that.
That's the problem with rebuilding that middle of your studio, is you cannot create a good military and like NCO core with under like DEI. So you can to some degree like get by with like Pajit and Asian women like grunts. They do not, they're not actually like good middle managers. Like Pajit middle managers are fucking like shoot me in the head.
Oh, no, and you're not going to have like fun blacks. They're these petty tyrants. That
and you can't just bring in a white guy. Yeah. If you poach, if you poach a white guy from like, say, Firaxis or whatever, and put him in the middle, you're going to get like objections. Like, well, he's not a Blizzard guy.
Which,
I'm a Blizzard
press
guy.
F
I've been here
for
long,
XCOM.
You know?
I don't know if you saw this, but Jake Solomon is basically like out and done and gone, and there will never be, I mean, I have to assume that there was some kind of, I don't know. It's interesting. It's obviously, it's a huge franchise and it has been a huge moneymaker for them, but Chimera Squad, which I might've been one of like the only, there was probably about 10 people who played through Chimera Squad and I was one of them. Well, I don't know. I think all my, unfortunately all that data was lost, but I did it essentially for this. I might have discussed it on the episode, but yeah, it was awful. And entirely predictable reasons.
Yeah, we went deep on Chimera Squad with
yes,
Mike.
Yes, I do.
That was
now
a fun,
that I'm talking about it, was, I remember that. Yeah. Oh God, it was so bad. And there have been not a peep since. Not a peep. And now Jake Solomon has left the building. And I mean, you have to imagine they will produce, like, there will be. Well, I don't know. I mean, I would say though, it's more likely than not that at some point in the future there will be.
I think you see a whole a reboot or something like that.
But when you only had like two mainline games and an expansion each, essentially, like there's no. I mean, I get what you're saying, but
how do you do
it?
XCOM
already
3
a reboot
anyway. Like the story is kind of wrapped up though, right? Like you can't do like. Well, I guess actually, I said there's one story you can do.
Thing. Like it's in it's subterranean yeah. Cthulhu shit, right?
Which is there's that, and I think you could actually do like you do the first game as normal XCOM, second game you're the Resistance, third game you're the oppressive human front. You know, like you're stamping
out.
But Chimera Squad,
evil. You go. You take it out to the star. XCOM to the stars. Yeah, that's
yeah.
A thing
like
you could do.
Human Empire, maybe. There's stuff you could do. But you
and
know,
Apocalypse had a lot of cool ideas.
But this is great. Yeah. I'm so glad we're talking about this because I guess it might be a next time episode. One of the games I have been playing that was not free, but it was like on super super Steam sale levels of sale on Game Pass was XCOM The Bureau. You remember this one?
Yes, I do remember it. I never played it.
It is a third person
action. Yeah,
Gears of War. Very much.
Yeah.
It is a mix between Gears of War and Mass Effect 2.
I heard it was middling. How? What's your verdict?
Okay, there are problems with it, but I am playing it. I finished the main campaign. I'm doing a couple of DLCs now. The DLCs are very short. I kind of get the point already, but very short is the problem for sure. It's like I think I beat the whole main campaign on not very hard, but like hard. Whatever, like the second hardest one was, which like the most playably hard. You know, was like somewhat playable. And I'll bring why it's the harder version is like unplayable in a second, but it's super Mass Effect influenced, dude. I was like, you saw this direction games kind of almost went, where like BioWare was almost much more influential than they were. Like every time you're in dialogue, you get the BioWare box,
yeah.
And I like that. I do. It brought back some nostalgia. I also realized like it's also not that good. You know, like there are problems with that system of like you say things and then like. kind of locked into a track of whatever, no matter what you say, because it's a video game, right? You have to do the next level. But, and, like, there are things that, like, people react to bizarrely, writing-wise. Like, there's a sequence when you are dealing with a, like, there's neutral party aliens. They're, like, ethereal light being type things. And your character is watching them make a decision, and you actually are speaking for one of the aliens too, because it's like a, it's kind of mind meld situation. And one alien's like, "Listen, we have to sacrifice humanity to stop the alien menace cold, right? If we, it'll cost us Earth and all humans, but you know, it's worth it because this could like wipe out all sentient life that's not enslaved to their thing, right?" And the other alien that I was playing as had two options: okay, yes, I understand, we should do this, or like, we're not doing this. I don't care. We're not sacrificing humanity. I picked the we're not going to sacrifice humanity option no matter what. And then it cuts to the human who is like eavesdropping on them, freaking out that the aliens are all going to, they're going to kill all of, like, this third party, are actually not a third party, they're going to kill all of the humans. Which doesn't make any fucking sense. Like, we just, the aliens had just discussed, like, you weren't supposed to pick that option. It didn't get the vibe you were. But the person, like, reacts. And so there's that issue, which has always been a kind of a BioWare issue.
It's a problem. Well, XCOM, it's the more linear the game is, the more of a problem it is.
Anyway,
for the most part, you could actually.
Yeah.
It was. I think it handled pretty well. But yes, with the second and especially the third, it was very much on rails. Sorry, go on.
Yeah, it was a weird bit of writing.
I actually saw this on Twitter too. There was a great comparison of like Fallout 3 dialogue options versus Fallout 4 dialogue options. Of like, and I, again, having never played Fallout 4, I hadn't ever been exposed directly to like four different variations on pretty much literally the exact same sentence as your quote unquote dialogue options. Versus, and Fallout 3 at the time was knocked, which I actually did enjoy, but it was knocked for, especially in comparison to the first two Fallout games, which you know, which are okay, these are almost text-based adventures, so it's not quite a fair comparison, but no, Fallout 3 had quite, you know, good comparable just about to the first Mass Effect in terms of the dialogue options, and yeah, just, and then New Vegas obviously as well, very much in that spirit. So yeah, okay. So it has problems, but no, I mean, you know, we're not.
It has more problem. It is. But so the XCOM game has this other interesting thing because it's XCOM, right? So, but it's in that Mass Effect style, one person with two squaddies who you can give orders to, and have, they have abilities. It has permadeath for the squaddies. So when one of them gets down, it starts a timer, and you have to revive them or they're permadead. And this gets bad with like wonky ass AI, right?
And,
like,
and on harder difficulties, it's just okay. Yes. Your guys go down, and then yeah.
Yeah, and they do some things where they cap the levels at 3, and they can level up outside of combat and doing certain tasks, which is like, so it's not like ever. I was never at a point where I was like seriously crippled with this. Also, you can, if you get downed in that same, normally if your person gets killed, you're getting killed pretty quick after that, you know, if you can't revive them, like, you're getting hit pretty quick. So it wasn't like terrible, but it was like a thing to worry about that was silly and seemed like very tacked on to like, oh, this is XCOM, whatever. At the hardest difficulty, which makes it actually unplayably because of the AI, why I couldn't do it and I chose to play the second hardest, was that when your squaddies get downed, you can when you revive them, they don't get back up, they're just like stabilized, and you got to pull in a new squaddie from like the ship, which is fine, it just instantly teleports them to you, but like they get downed so often I would run out of squaddies by the end of the mission, right? Like they're your guys are idiots, right? Because it's just a, you know, it's one of those games, right? Where if you don't use cover, enemies, on the hard, because the enemies are like, have their own abilities, they're whipping grenades at you, they're doing all kind of stuff. But the gameplay itself is very enjoyable. There are some weird things, like ammo scarcity is brutal. Like in Mass Effect, you never run out of ammo. It's like almost unheard of, right? This ties you to that hard two gun time limit or carry limit. So like you run out pretty quick. Enemies are pretty tough and bullet spongy. It's got some Gears of War influence in that respect.
I've hated this always, and the older I get, the more I'm like, fuck bullet sponges. Like, it's just the dumb.
It's worse in Gears. There is an element that they want you to use your abilities to circumvent that aspect of it, right? Like, you're supposed to be using your talents and tricks and psychic abilities to, like, to catch enemies out of cover and do stuff and freeze them in spot places. Like, it's they want you to explore the game and it not just be a pop cover shooter. So I get why it was chosen, but the running out of ammo and running across like these levels in a firefight where it's like a cover-based shooter, so if you're not in cover, you're just fucked to like, pick up more ammo.
Yeah.
Gets pretty rough. And then they do a very weird XCOM thing where you can see that they cut like the tech tree aspect. So like the only way to gain weapons is to pick them up from dead aliens. So like a percentage of you loot will drop kinda, their
yeah,
gun.
Kinda clever, yeah.
Yeah, but there it gets weird with like gating stuff. Certain stuff won't drop, you know? So you get into weird spots where you feel like your weapons should be more powerful and like certain enemies aren't dropping them in this level, you know, because of like that would give you the alien sniper rifle too early and stuff. So there is a cool aesthetic where you're running in with like 1960s era guns, like you had M14s and trench shotguns and stuff and like, you know, Springfield scope type rifles. It's very fun. But like it gets to the point where like the alien guns are just so much better. Like it's a very cool aesthetic to have your noir type agents deploy with like, you know, M14s to fight aliens. But like at a certain point you need like you're just kind of
jerking off to the M14. I may even have gotten it during a Humble Bundle or something. I believe I have.
You probably did. I think I already had it on PC as well.
Was I think I paid like $5 for literally every XCOM game ever at some point.
I think I got that too. I think I have it on PC. Yeah. I had tried to play it on PC. So,
I'm curious. I may give it a spin.
Definitely play with the controller. Mm-hmm. I had bounced off it a couple years ago trying to play it on mouse and keyboard. But that kind of Mass Effect game is kind of designed for I find that like you pop the weapon, pop the freeze time, and do the orders. I found that to be a much better experience with the console.
Finally, because we are pushing like half an hour. I think that's like I don't you know we could talk more about video games. But I did want to mention because I had forgotten about it entirely. The Great Rebellion is out now, and it's currently as of this speaking, and I think for at least another week or so on sale, 20% off. So definitely support our guys. I purchased it, but I haven't been able to play it yet. I will soon, and maybe that'd be good content for our video game section. Next week,
downloaded it. I have played it. I was playing on a laptop and tried to mouse and keyboard it. It didn't quite feel right. I think you need a controller. Just a quick tip.
Sure.
Definitely have a controller. It feels very much like a controller game. I'm sure like you could play it on it with a mouse and keyboard, but you play the skills. I was playing on a hard difficulty too, so maybe the skill ceiling is you know higher. You have to maybe have to get good with the mouse, but I'm just gonna hook my Xbox controller up to the computer and play it. It'll be fine.
Yeah,
it ran fine. You know, I get it. It's got some European stuff. You know, very European, but that's the kind of point, right?
Yes.
Do you want to transition to geopolitics real quick?
Geopolitics. Or? Yes. Would you rather do Israel stuff or Ukraine stuff first?
I have Israel news, but I think you're more hot excited for Ukraine stuff, right?
Broadly, but we could do Israel. I don't really mind.
Okay, so. I guess we're cut. So very lucky we didn't get like news cucked by this, but it was close. So it was a very close thing. But basically, the I guess internal demands of the coalition government, like so, it's on the verge of a breakup. Basically, so the blue and white type faction, right? So that's center right, but anti-Netanyahu. Benny Gantz is the big voice. He's probably gonna, if there were elections today, he'd probably be prime minister. Probably. But anyway, they demanded by I believe it was June 8th, right, that there needs to be a unified war plan, like objectives. Like they don't have to say it, they have to be a set objectives in the like by the war cabinet. And by June 8th, or they're going to withdraw from the government, blue and white is, and force an election or something, right? How that works in the context of a ongoing war, who the fuck knows, right? But,
well, is there, I mean, obviously in some sense there's an ongoing war, but I would actually say.
So there's no, I have some news for you.
Yeah,
there's no operational plan and people are pissed, right?
Right.
So the IDF
there is no, I submit to you, there is no Gaza war.
So the IDF is transitioning to a very long war footing. They are currently regularizing their brigades in Gaza. I believe there are 9 brigades in Gaza currently. One of them is a reservist brigade. One of them is a training brigade, which is a kind of an in-betweener status. That's consider it closer to regular. It's a weird status they have. It's basically regulars with like some conscripts that aren't fully like. It's weird, but it's basically they're basically regulars with reservists around when they actually deploy. Anyway, in the beginning of the war, when they first entered Gaza, it was about half and half. So half mobilized reservists and half regulars in training battalions. Now it's 7 out of 9 are regulars. Regulars are volunteer contract soldiers and people currently doing their 2 years or 2.5 years. So they are going to regularize the conflict so they can maintain it for a long time, send their troops home, and kind of just maintain this forever occupation in Gaza. And
okay, but in order for there to be a war, there have to be war goals. Like, what are the war goals?
This is the complaint, because and this is what Gantz basically is advocating. Gantz is saying there needs to be a plan to the biggest thing is they need to what's the plan in Gaza? Like, what's the
on the news earlier, which the argument was essentially Netanyahu said something to the effect of, or I forget who said it what first, but essentially Netanyahu at some point said, we don't have a specific plan. However, we have a framework where essentially there will never be Palestinian sovereignty. There will never be anything like the Palestinian Authority essentially is finished, at least in Gaza. There will never be a point at which Palestinians will be in charge of their own thing, whatever that thing is, whatever status it has under Israel. It's essentially Israel will manage directly at the governmental level Gaza, which then I believe it was Lapid came out and said, like, this is unacceptable. And, you know, essentially, like, this is he called on Netanyahu to repudiate those remarks and commit that there, like, when this will end, and when it is over, there will, like, the Israel will not be directly managing affairs in Gaza. To which Netanyahu responded,
yes, the current COPE is actually unified Palestinian, Israeli, and American administration in Gaza.
Is that you mean the Lapid COPE?
No, that's like the current, I believe the government, in some capacity, said this.
This was a few days ago, but Netanyahu said essentially, like, he told Lapid to fuck off, and he was like, no,
tough, but they've cucked.
Okay,
so
they
far.
Have cucked. That,
the
that
initial
was my,
plan
okay,
was.
Yeah. No, well, like, no, we're going to manage. Well, they said, I refuse to commit, but you're not going to manage. And in fact, I reiterate that we will directly manage Gaza. Last I heard.
So when it comes to that, the long war, short war thing, if they were doing the, you know, Gantz plan where they're going to, like, win in theory, or they would have deployed what they deployed earlier, like, much more manpower, much more reservists, trying to end this thing versus kind of stabilize it into a permanent thing. Like an ongoing forever war in the which would fuck up Israel. And there's a reason Israel doesn't occupy Gaza. They can't. Like they wanted to. They used to. Up until they left it, they had it. But Netanyahu's on a trend of cucking where initially the claim was, we're going to resettle. We're going to put settlements back into Gaza. That was fully Netanyahu repudiated his remarks that way. In that direction, like Netanyahu, so they're on a trend of cucking.
Yes, that's right, because he also said, well, not only are we going to manage Gaza directly, but we're going to put all our people back in the illegal settlements.
We're going to restart the illegal settlements in Gaza, which they were before they were kicked out, because they can't occupy Gaza. It's just not possible. So the broader trend of the bar demands a war plan, right? Because right now there's people the stronger parties in the war cabinet want short war and a peace deal by September, basically. They haven't said peace deal by September, but they said they want to return all the civilians about 1 million that had to flee the north under the justified and proportional response by Hezbollah. They had to flee their just deserts, and Gantz says, we need a plan to have the North resettled by September, which means a peace deal with Hezbollah in September, right?
Well, okay, and so this speaks to me to, like, what I mean, I said it kind of tongue-in-cheek, but when I say there's no war in Gaza, like, really? It's reversed with Ukraine. Like, Russia calls Ukraine a special military operation, and everybody makes fun of it, but, like, this actually is essentially a police action by, like, there has been no... What's going on in Ukraine obviously has been a war, regardless of what Russia calls it, from day one. Everybody talks about the Gaza war. This isn't a war. Okay, there are, like, army units lining up and fighting each other and killing each other, but I think in terms, like, structurally, really, well, I guess you could think, if you want to think of it, it's a counterinsurgency. But even that, I think, falls short, because the claim is this is just our territory. I mean, Israel doesn't, I don't know. It's a very confused situation. But I mean, when you factor in, especially, like, just the way supply works, like, I mean, the idea that you're going to have because Hamas is, as you've emphasized, essentially a conventional army, except their entire logistics network is underground, and a huge, probably what, two thirds, three quarters at least, comes from outside, through Egypt, Jordan, whatever. Right? Like,
and if you've read up on Mao, Peter, I think I've said it before, I'm gonna reiterate it. The hardest part to deal with insurgency is in there's multiple phases of insurgency, right? Mao puts it as four or zero or one being, like, just organizing it as a above ground political thing with, like, just ideas and such, right? At one, you're in that kind of pure guerrilla warfare state. At two or three, depending on how you measure it, right? There's all kinds of different theories. So I like the Vietnamese guy theory, but whatever. We're getting very autistic. Like,
this podcast.
I'm a big Ho Chi Minh, but his second, I believe it was Diet or Diet, some with a D. He wrote, like, the actual book. Ho Chi Minh was very old by this time.
Sure.
He actually wrote, like, basically a addendum to basically Mao's guerrilla warfare. Organized slightly differently. I think it's superior, but anyway. They both had this phase where
comparative Mao's insurgency theoretical.
Yes, yeah.
I love it. Yeah, sorry, go on.
Yeah, no, that's what I do. It's what we do here. But anyway, at this second, third stage, there's this phase where you have a guerrilla force that is capable of not just doing guerrilla actions, but conducting conventional military operations, right? So they can become conventional or guerrilla actions as, like, the situation demands, right? And the third phase is you just become a regular army, like the NVA. So, like, obviously in Vietnam, you had regular NVA units and, like, the Viet Cong, and the Viet Cong could become a conventional raid. The NVA could do guerrilla actions and vice versa. And when you're a conventional army, you can be defeated in a conventional war. It's your highest risk. Like, the highest risk point of the Vietnam War for the North Vietnamese was the invasion of South Vietnam after the U.S. pulled out, right? Because they had a conventional army in the field that could have just lost the war, right? And once your conventional army is annihilated, the guys who would have been your guerrillas are in that army, and they're all dead or captured or dealt with, right? So it's very hard to go back down this scale once you're doing a full conventional operation. You can't return. It's very hard to return to guerrilla operations. The Germans obviously couldn't do it in World War II because the Ukrainians won't be able to do it in future.
Yeah, I was going to say, which, by the way, not to, like, jump tracks, but I heard this cope the other day. I think Willie OAM said the other day something, like, within the past couple of days, like, oh, well, you know, even if Russia wins, is going to be all this guerrilla gladio shit. I'm like, I don't think so, man. I really don't.
Yeah, your volunteer. Remember, guerrillas are all volunteer, 100% volunteer, right? Once your volunteer base are tapped out in conventional operations, they're tapped out. Like, you're not going to find it. There's no. So you'll have an initial.
People talk about the French resistance, but, like, first of all,
there was a French resistance.
Yeah,
it's not real. I just want to get that out.
But also,
French propaganda.
Right. Right, because people were fine with it. It was like, okay, whatever. But also, the people who participated in that were essentially, what was it? The French, large parts of them were essentially the people who would have volunteered to serve in the French military, except for the fight was over in a couple weeks, so none of that ever happened. So that manpower pool was available in a way that it just wouldn't be in any other circumstances.
Yes, guerrilla operations require on recruiting to replace losses, outpacing losses, right? And you get a large initial burst of, like, demobilized or whatever, but then after the first, like, year of guerrilla operations, at absolute best, they're just you're just done because there's no pool to tap anymore. That's where Hamas is right now. They conducted conventional operations in October 7th, and in very small company-scale conventional operations, but they're all doing constant, they're picking their fights in guerrilla actions. And I really, honestly, truly believe that
in
they're
super Kino guerrilla actions that make for awesome footage if you haven't seen it yet.
Yeah. Yes. I truly believe Hamas fighters, in terms of like direct action, like shooting each other, have a even or positive like KDR here. Now they will have more losses because of them like just getting Hamas fighters are there so many of them they'll get caught up in the indiscriminate like civilian murder stuff.
There's no reason to believe that Israel is winning KDR on a per engagement basis. I don't see any evidence of that. I see a lot of evidence of the contrary.
So that's big, right? I mean, they're positive overall because like the indiscriminate civilian murder will catch a lot of fighters because they're, you know, guerrillas, right?
And you see this with the ghouls on like the fucking conservatar Twitter sometimes. They're like, people will say about, you know, the number of tens of thousands of people
killed
by Israeli bombs. They're like, yeah,
these
but they're all innocent, right?
The IDF, I'm going to put post about on the Telegram at some point. The IDF released a list of child collaborators.
Well, you saw
like,
that
with the Hamas.
That's fucking insane.
No, basically, they released this list of civilian collaborators with Hamas who said, like, you are basically good to go targets unless you contact us to,
like legal
reverse collaborate.
According to the IDF, these are legal targets.
No, they're declaring them, like, yeah, we're going to kill you, these people, their names and, like, phone and, like, pictures, unless they, like, start working for us. Dude, some of these kids look like they're 4 years old.
Yeah,
like, it's obscene. I fucking hate these Jews, man. I hate them. But, anyway, that's why Hamas, like, it's very hard to lose the guerrilla war when you're in stage two, because in stage one, you do, like, counterinsurgency or, like, anti-bandit, like, police, law enforcement type tasks, right? You can win those. You can, like, an army can do that. And then in the third phase, you can just lose a conventional war, right? It happens all the time. An army cannot do both conventional warfare and anti-guerrilla, anti-bandit, law enforcement type tasks. Like you literally can't do both as an operationally. It's just not something that's possible. It's kind of a lost technology that like the British were doing it in India. Like you need it's a very weird like package of you need to like be building a competent army of native troops led by your officers. That's just not actually viable in the modern era with modern technology. Like yes, it made sense in. For like a sepoy battalions in like the Raj, and they're probably the only ones that ever pulled off, and also like you know once again Indian military like martial valor,
and also India
not quite the thing.
Enormously
and,
fragmented, so you could take Indians from one part of India would just be like they would have no attachment to quote unquote Indians. You know,
there's all kind of reasons why you could pull the British were able to pull it off, but also they weren't like they lost in Afghanistan. Like the British were not. Bulletproof, but like they were probably the last people to ever actually like be good at this kind of thing in any meaningful way. So there's that, and you can basically win in phase one and three. It's almost impossible to win in phase two. Just is. So there's that, and then to return to the demands of the other demand is normalization with Saudi Arabia, right? The Gantz is a big advocate for like the Abraham Accords type shit. And that whole thing has been, like, thrown off. He wants that to become a priority. Which is code for a peace deal. Like, Saudi Arabia will not normalize short of a peace. He did, basically...
Yeah. I don't even know if they would. I mean, I guess their government sucks bad enough that they might. But, yeah.
That thing is code for, it's code for a peace deal, though, right? And also letting aid, like, Saudi aid and Emirati aid into the Strip. Which is there and waiting, right? The September timeline and that this implies a peace deal by September, and his like counter
just
push
in time
to this
for the
like
U.S.
he's,
election, I guess, yeah.
No, well, to avoid the U.S. election, I think
right,
it's
that's
to
what I
be
mean.
Yeah. Do they want to? Because there will be an American
election. Yeah,
there will be such a protester. It's gonna be insane. The protester, right? Like,
dude, I'm psyched already. Get the fucking popcorn.
I'll be there, nigga. I'll be there. And then his fourth point, which is very important. It just kind of the stick, right? To his carrot is he wants to draft the Orthodox.
Oh, I saw that.
Subject
them
to the draft.
Yes. Yeah.
And this balloon was tested and shot down, right? This is not a serious proposal. This is not a serious proposal to draft the Orthodox. I want to get that clear. They are not going to draft them. What they are doing is getting Smotrich, Bezalel Smotrich, and Ben-Gavir, the demon gods of this community, to shut the fuck up. Because these guys have been fucking stuff up. And this is a threat. Like, hey, if you guys can't keep it together, we're going to draft.
Keep your spaghetti in your pants, or...
And just accede to this. Like, you're not... Like, they're not a majority yet. Like, you're not a majority yet. They're still a, you know, minority party. Get fucked. And even though, like, they're growing, it's not yet, right? So...
I don't think Israel has long enough to the where this is going to be an actual issue, but I'm curious if they did attain majority status, because they are the fastest breeding like species of rat in Israel. What does that look like? I mean, how do you even conduct this level of operation under the...
What would happen is also they're electorally slightly, maybe, there's another like 20% of their voter base that actually, of these parties, that isn't actually Orthodox. Like, a lot of, like, there's a lot of Mizrahi. So the Orthodox thing is like specifically Ashkenazi insanity, right? Where they do the Torah study all day and don't do anything else. There are Mizrahis who are as fanatical but don't have the same, like, rights and religious reasons to do that kind of thing.
Sure.
That vote with them.
Gotcha.
I imagine... So, like, when you see that they're voting stats, that's not, like, 100% non-draftable population. There's, like, Mizrahis who are just extreme but still consider themselves subject to the draft for theological reasons. Like, when you see those really insane preachers, or rabbis, I guess, who are, like, Every Israeli gets 10 goyim slaves. Those are actually the Mizrahi got. Well, they're retarded, right? They're retarded, like, they're Arabized, Muslimized, fucking Jew retards. Those guys and their congregations are draftable, I assume, in order to acquire goyim slaves. It's possible you get, like, to this point of undraftability, but it's not... It's more of a just them being bad at foreign policy, right? They'll just be retarded.
Yeah.
And there will be a... And probably an exodus of people, too. Like, an exodus of like, you know, liberal Jews. They're going to start oppressing, like, the actual... There are anti-Zionist Jews, like, about 3% in Israel, very funnily. Those niggas are going to get oppressed. Like, as soon as these retards get in charge, they're going to... They're all going to... That 3% is just going to leave, flat out. Like, so... There's that. So, I see this as... Basically, Gantz is advocating more war in the short term in order to win, quote-unquote. That means... to get a peace deal. I think the war plan would be 40 to 60 brigades in Gaza, most of them reservists, crash this place, like, get it, fuck it up really hard, and then leave and make the Saudis rebuild it. And part of that deal would be like, hey, we normalize relations with the Saudis, they can send in aid to rebuild the strip. Like that. So basically fuck it up so hard that, like, it's basically non-functional with a large amount of people, and then leave and make it the Saudis and the Turks' problem and the Egyptians to, like, rebuild with aid money. And then in that fell swoop, also cut a deal with Hezbollah by September. And, like, that would end the war, quote unquote. Then you demobilize.
Yeah, and then everybody gets a pony.
Whereas the current IDF plan and the Netanyahu plan is long war forever with the constant, like, maybe we mobilize the reserves and send them north to try to lose a fourth Litani River Bowl against the fucking Hezbollah, like, at some point. And that'll kind of, as a sort of Damocles, that they can kind of hang over Lebanon and the rest of the world and, like, negotiate from what they see as a position of strength rather than weakness, right?
Well, I mean, at least that's...
Where this goes, who knows?
Yeah, of course. It's unpredictable, for sure. More so than things are normally...
Also, I want to bring up Hamas is... Hamas has 100% command and control continuity. They have 100% internal supply continuity. The Jews are still not flying Apaches over there to support their troops, which means that they understand Hezbollah is still intact. They have limited numbers of manpads, Iglo launchers that would down these Apaches. If they didn't have command and control and supply lines throughout the Strip, the Israelis could just, like, focus in areas where they weren't. But they understand that if they start flying Apaches in an area, that Hamas leadership can get those Iglo teams there fast, so they just don't... They only fly dust-offs, medevacs. They're not flying attack helicopters. In videos, you are not seeing the fighters engage tanks with anti-personnel RPGs. They are still using, they are currently still matching their mission set in both ways. When you see them shoot at troops, they're shooting high explosives or frag RPG warheads. When they're shooting armored vehicles, they're shooting the tandem YSOMs. So we know that, like, they're getting missions. They're getting the gear for missions. That's correct and matched. They're not being forced to use, you know, KASAMs for anti-personnel or high explosive for anti-armor. Like, they're doing a very excellent job. You're seeing, they're still using fucking bullets. They're using, like, machine guns against, you know, unarmored soldiers in ambushes. They're using IEDs. They're tunneling directly, like, they're building tunnels for particular mission sets, right? Their manpower has to be high because these are tunnels that are for raids, like single-use built tunnels. And you can see because they're shittier. Like when you see them escape into like a shitty dirt tunnel, you know that was a quick built for mission raid. When you see them popping out of concrete tunnels, the pressure's on them, right? They're using their like network tunnels instead of these like single mission tunnels, which they can destroy behind them, right? So Hamas is totally functional. They are totally capable right now. They are not degraded. I mean, they've taken manpower losses, right? But they are not degraded as a force. And that's a big deal. And everyone knows it. And the cure for this in Gantz's eyes is big war fast. And in Netanyahu IDF leadership right now is long war. We just get used to this return to this kind of status quo of just this war forever and ever. So that's where I see it going. And Hamas is doing very well, and Hamas is like has a vote in this election, right? And they're I don't know which side they'd prefer. Like, I guess I'm sure actually they want peace now at this point. But
Hamas, you think wants?
Yeah, they want this to stop at this point. Like, they do have supply problems that I've reported with it's things like food in terms of command and control, arms, not a problem. But like, right. Hamas is not okay. This is gonna sound like heresy to the Western fucking analysts, but like, Hamas is not like the ruling elite of Gaza. They are just the people, right? So there are no like secret. There are underground hospitals for fighters, but there is no like food supply for fighters only. Like, the food that goes into Gaza for the people is going to Hamas, and Hamas's food stores are also open to people. They're not watching their people starve. It's not happening. Like, it's just not, like,
yeah.
The idea of Gaza as Hamas fighters is like getting fat and happy. Like, when you started seeing malnutrition deaths among children, Hamas fighters at that point were also very hungry. Now there's been some level of aid restored to where there's some people are getting enough people aren't dying of hunger anymore, right? Which means Hamas fighters aren't dying of hunger anymore. So or weakened by hunger. So Hamas is in the game so much that the Jews are I think very shook. I think Gantz specifically and the Gantz faction is very shook.
Yeah, I don't know. The whole thing seems very unrealistic to me. I guess I understand that. I think you're probably right that certainly Hamas could use an operational pause, and even if they are on balance, in I think winning in kind of a strategic sense, that yes, it's costing the Palestinian people dearly, and they are not immune from that. I do think, though, that not only is Israel losing strategically, they're also just their situation is so unstable, and they are, I guess, yeah, who knows? And there's a lot of resilience built into these systems, but the kind of instability that a ceasefire deal would introduce, the extent to which it's unacceptable for crucial members, not just of the governing coalition, but Israeli society. I guess it would be the smart thing to do to declare victory and go home with your tail tucked between your legs and take your lumps. That would at least kind of kick the can down the road far enough to give you some room to maneuver. It's also dangerous inherently for its own reasons, but I have a really hard time. Like, I think if that as the minute a deal is signed, Netanyahu's out. I guess you could have a kind of like the blue and white ex-military sort of soft military coup, quasi, you know, secular nationalist military run government in Israel that okay. Maybe
well, if they call for elections now, like if the blue and white guys drop, they leave the war cabinet.
That's what he wants in September. Like there's a deal, you know, or what, you know, let's say they go in with 60 brigades or whatever. It's a mirror image of the issue that Russia's facing in Ukraine or was facing in January 22, or I guess maybe more like March or April 22, where there was that peace deal on the table. In other words, not immediately before, but in this aftermath of the initial push where, okay, we could freeze the current line of conflict as a de facto international border. But sooner or later, this just, it's an unstable equilibrium. Like eventually this will fall apart because it can't not fall up. Like all roads lead to this conflict flaring up again.
And Israel losing, right?
And Israel losing pretty much like the same, at least as bad.
Yeah, they're not going to win the peace deal, whatever that means. You know, they're not going to win the peace, whatever happens after this, right?
Overall, I'm skeptical that this is going to continue to escalate. Although there are signs that it might. I mean, to some extent, it depends on the domestic Israeli political situation.
What that even looks like, though, is weird. Like, what more could you do other than sending more troops into Gaza, right?
Like that being international is what I mean. Essentially, then expands to a proper war with Lebanon. And
The thing is, there's a weird thing where there's only one. Israel is constrained. There's only one front to invade. Like, they can't invade Egypt. They have deals going on. They can't invade Jordan. They can't invade Syria, because if they invade Syria, it's gonna be a whole fucking thing, right? Like, they could maybe pretend that, but like, you're getting to weave some wild stuff where, like, okay, well, like, now there's a fucking Iranian tank battalion headed your way, because fuck it, right? Like, you're in Syria territory. So they can only go into Lebanon, which is of all those countries, the toughest one to invade because of Hezbollah. So, like, oops, you know? But you mentioned this, like, unstable equilibrium kind of situation. Do you want to shift to Ukraine, where things are getting, like,
absolutely,
I don't know, oddly stabler?
So, I'm not sure what you, certainly not militarily, but unless we maybe just disagree, but go on.
So mentioned last episode how, like, we're not seeing brigade-sized actions, right?
Mm-hmm.
It has come to my attention, and some good analysts have shown some very solid evidence that the first at least week of the Kharkiv raid invasion, we're going to call it, like, the operations into the Ukrainian border from Kharkiv, were conducted by an infantry brigade, operating as an infantry brigade, right? So they weren't, like, sending single battalions from multiple brigades to achieve objectives that would be reinforced by their parent brigades. It was one brigade, about 2,000, maybe 2,500 guys, achieving all of the initial objectives of this operation. Now, of course, there's been reinforcements, and they've kind of, now that they've got the foothold, but the foothold operate, like the beachheads, both beachheads actually were run by the same brigade, parent brigade. So relatively small force commitment into the operation. Probably 10,000 total troops actually entering Ukraine. Who knows? At least 2,000. But like the other brigades were providing support. They were not providing like the manpower and the reinforcements. Now they are. It's, like, you know, it's a wider front. But the initial was a single brigade action. And that this is the weirdest thing that I have a theory on now, is that they were green. These brigades had not seen combat before. They were operating in some ways that got pointed out by even Ukrainian analysts that, like, when they came, they weren't hit while it happened, but there was drone footage, by which side I don't know, of them emerging from one of the forest belts, and they're in, like, company parade formation, like one of these, you know, to get to the forest, which is something you do to get to the forest quickly, but, like, they don't, like, you don't hang out. Before you leave the forest, you string out or make yourself into whatever formation you want. You don't, like, leave the forest as a company march formation and then, like, then dissipate it outside the forest. It's easier, but you don't do that because you all get hit. But, like, that's a very green type of thing. But they were very effective in that same respect, right? So you gotta, you know, look at what they're doing here. I think this may have been a local command decision, because, like, the mission is, like, prevent further border incursions into Kharkiv, right?
You mean into Belgorod?
Yeah, into Belgorod. This was probably operational goal of creating
to push
a buffer zone.
Artillery that's been hitting Belgorod back to a position where they'll no longer.
Yeah.
I think there's something to that, and it may.
And there is talk of getting artillery low enough to do interdiction on Kharkiv, which is absolutely possible. That's a goal or a secondary objective, but the first objective seems to have been like there will be no more invasions of Belgrade.
Yes,
and
Russian pro-Russian autist mapper on YouTube, Military Summary, noted there are four positions from which. There are four positions outside Belgorod from which artillery is coming into Belgorod, two of which are these towns that have been in the news, Vovchansk and Lipsy.
Lipsy's is important because it can hit, it's in a weird situation. It can hit, well, weird, it's how maps work. It could hit both Belgrade and Kharkiv City with, like, if artillery are there, you can hit both, you know, you could hit the other capital. So it is the most key point in these terms.
Yeah, and I'm definitely sympathetic to your. It's certainly a possibility. I think the anomalous phenomenon that needs to be accounted for is the small size of the Russian force coming down from the northern border. I do think there are indications that it's a reconnaissance in force. I mean, there are two ways to look at it. Is this a part of a broader strategic plan or is it not? I've said for a while and
I don't like reconnaissance in force because the to get political sign off on that
for
would
green,
be almost
for green guys is yeah, it's tough.
Well, but even like for because if you're going to imply reconnaissance in force implies you will then retreat, right? Being kicked out of Kharkiv again is unacceptable, right? Like it would be. If they were repulsed,
okay,
right,
well,
or they fell back,
sure,
that would be.
But then there's this other
untenable part
of it, which is these border fortifications were essentially completely undone. And while we were initially making fun, and I will still make fun, I think a large part of the reason why probably the main reason why these fortifications are so woefully incomplete, it's not so much because of the corruption, although that's there, it's because it's incapable, like they were physically unable, or at least for people who aren't. Like going to be thrown in jail if they don't complete the mission of stringing out these dragon's teeth. If you start stringing out the dragon's teeth and you start getting hit by artillery, like, okay, I'm a private contractor. I'm getting the fuck out of here. Now it's presumably somebody's, I'm referencing, I assume people would have seen it, but in case they haven't, if you need a refresher or for, you know, listening to this at some point in the future, there've been these very funny, very famous photographs of piles of dragon's teeth, these anti-tank obstacles just being dumped at road intersections, these critical locations in the border with Russia, and just left there. So people are talking about corruption, and I'm sure there's some of that. And at some point, yes, it would have been on some kind of military official to sign off and say, yes, this was done correctly. But as a private contractor, you're under no, I mean, you're just, there's no, you know, you would rather like get fined or whatever than lose the contract than literally get fucking killed, which is the dilemma that would have been presenting itself for, you know, a lot of cases. So
there's another issue I've noted that I don't know if it's pushback or whatever, but I have seen a lot of other pro-Ukrainian comments. It's not blaming, they're saying, oh, the fortification, yes, I said all this is bad, but that individual units in the areas refused to dig in themselves. Like, so, and this is a common issue with Slavic armies since the First World War and maybe even prior, is that they don't like to dig, right? They will do it, obviously, to survive, right? Like, they're not afraid of digging trenches, but their trenches are kind of shitty. The Russians have been trying to break this since, like, World War One. But there's this thing, in the Second World War was big, where, like, you would have designated, like, labor battalions that would be digging, and, like, soldiers don't want to dig, and when Azov went to Avdiivka, they were complaining about being told to dig, and, like, not wanting to, or that the previous units hadn't dug, and they should have dug, and who digs is a weird thing. Slavic armies are it's like a slower status thing, and they try to break it through propaganda stuff, like, oh, it's shovels and whatever, and tender trenching is important, but like non-engineering or labor battalions digging is like a weird thing that they don't like doing. And the Russians have the same problem, right? You saw a whole Russian internal propaganda bit where they were showing off like what a really nice trench system looks like on the inside, and it's like a basically
yes,
like
I remember
college dorm.
Orthodox icons and stuff. And
yes, that is propaganda, right? Like they are trying to get their guy. Hey, if you dig well, it can be fucking comfortable. You fucking idiots! Like this is a problem. Since World War I, it was remarked upon by the Germans when they took a Soviet trench, a Tsarist trench.
Yes.
Yeah, that like wow, this is a fucking shithole. Like what? How do they live like this? And there was a comparable phenomenon where Soviet troops would, Tsarist troops would get dispatched to a piece of front line and immediately launch an attack and take massive casualties to take a German trench because that was a better trench. And to avoid digging their own, they would like a reinforcement battalion comes and just immediately assaults the nearest thing.
I'm forwarding it to you now on Telegram. You can see our friend of the show, Blofeld, on Telegram has a picture of German trenches and deep dugouts, a schematic diagram that illustrates exactly what you're talking. I was just seeing this like earlier this morning. I'm like, funny that you're mentioning how nice German trenches are.
It's very comfy, right?
Looks great.
And that's a part of like units doing it themselves, right? If you ever read Infantry Attacks by Rommel about his First World War experience. He is like from day one. He's like we march all day, then we dig all night. Like that's the point. Like you dig in, and if you don't, you're gonna get fucking shredded. And I think a lot of that was like officers in the German army being more paternalistic. I think like you know these are your sons and such things. Like there's certain German attitudes, and then also like you have to also get your hands dirty to some degree and help them dig too. Like whereas there's a big in Slavic armies. Big differentiator between like elite and non-elite units, and units will self-identify as elite, and that means they don't dig anymore, right? So like your guards, whatever, your
shock
assault,
army,
whatever.
Yeah.
So, yeah. These people don't dig; they attack, and they'll fall into existing trenches, no problem. But
they don't dig.
Digging, not so much, right?
That speaks, I think, all the more to Sir Vikken's great success in having completed his eponymous line. The south.
Also, we don't know how much that was done by like. See, he probably had access to engineering units, right? And like regular, I'm sure that there were normal units, motor stalky units digging too. But like, there were absolutely like engineering units, labor battalions, these things, you know.
That would also
digging.
Help explain sort of why it was always kind of a mystery to me why NATO expect like okay. I think they were just saying this shit about Russian morale just to say they're like, oh, the Russians are going to run. I don't think they ever actually believed that. But they did seem to believe that they would just be able to break through kind of just because. This at least provides a motivation for that reasoning. I'm like, yeah, well, you know, we can see whatever kind of defensive works, but probably it's just kind of bullshit and fake because, let's be real, these are Russians. I could see that sort of helps me make sense of...
Also, if you look at all the strong points in this war, like Avdiivka, that was... made strong over the course of 5 years of construction.
Bosnia was since 2014 and a lot of other places too. I think
construction companies.
I don't know about like the full extent, but Avdiivka has been continuously fortified since 2014. That I think is like one of to zoom out now a little bit. And I'm not sure, maybe you can explain what you were saying, what you meant earlier when you said that you thought things were stabilizing. I think the opposite. And a large part of that is because essentially Russia is now in the process currently, I mean, over the past couple of weeks, essentially, of reaching and tearing down the last of the fortifications that have been continuously improved upon since 2014. They are once they are clear of this current belt, which would include Chasiv Yar, but I almost at that point you're talking about a secondary line outside of like the Donbass or the Donetsk front itself. What they're doing now, these are areas like in the immediate outside of Donetsk City that have been entrenched since 2014. Those trenches are now, and defensive works are now being cleared. There are other works that have been made to some extent since 2014, but nothing is extensive, and most of it quite shoddy, especially like the closer you get to Donetsk, essentially, the better the fortification works are almost linearly. And that's going to be a, like, watch that story, because they will try. I imagine they're going to, I mean, there's currently, I see this on Ukrainian Twitter and Telegram all over the place about, like, oh, we're going to be, sometimes it's a cope, sometimes it's an expectation, sometimes I guess it's both. But, oh, we're just going to dig in now, you know, we're going to find a place. And I'm sure there are, like, local spots that they can, you know, there where either something already exists that can be improved, or it's in, there's a natural, you know, there's the Volga River, of course, and things like this. But, no, I don't think it's, like, it's entirely a different beast to try to entrench under fire.
Yeah.
And I just, yeah. Sorry, what were you going to say?
So when I say it's stable, are you feel the concept of a battle rhythm or sure. a tempo?
Yeah.
Rhythm is, the tempo means like just doing something a lot, right? But rhythm is a very more specific thing. It was used a lot during counterinsurgency stuff, like finding a good battle rhythm, because it's, we need it all the time. But basically it's what you're doing every day is the same thing, right? Like, you're doing very, like, you know what to expect. You know what your rest, attack, fight, defend cycle is. You know these, you expect what's happening and it to stay this way for a while, right? And it's a good thing. I think both sides have fallen into a rhythm in Donetsk where the Ukrainians are okay with the speed at which they're losing ground, and the Russians are okay with how much they're gaining, right? And both sides are, like, there will be complaints and thinking, oh, we should losing ground a lot, but the they're not losing ground at breakneck speed. The defenses are relatively tough, and then they pull back before they take massive losses, right? And the Russians are okay at, like, okay, well, we're going to lose a shitload more. We're doing it this way with these battalion attacks of basically tanks, convoys, and BMP convoys led by a fucking turtle tank down these roads and pretty straightaway attacks. We're going to lose that kind of... Yes. We're going to lose more vehicles this way, but we're going to gain this ground and take these losses, right? I think, like, everyone is kind of okay with where they're at right now in a way that's going to stabilize like this for months. I think you'll kind of see this pattern of these things. Chasiv Yar, the Ukrainians could make it into a Bakhmut if they want, but that doesn't seem to be like what they're... They're not like doing the bit of like Chasiv Yar will never surrender. Like, we're going to create this into a Bakhmut. It seems like this is a point where they'll hold them longer than they would if there was just a fucking smaller town here. But you know, everyone's kind of happy with their own battle rhythm of like the Ukrainians think, oh, we are inflicting enough losses here. The Russians say we're gaining enough ground here and also inflicting enough losses here. I think that what changed this is probably the FABs, the bombs. The bombs changed this where, like, the Ukrainians can't build strong points that they can man heavily anymore.
There's no answer to...
But that means you adapt and you create this kind of fighting, not fighting retreat, slower than that. It's basically almost guerrilla in its... But it's like, it's not a fighting retreat, right? They're not falling back, but they're, like, kind of a leapfrogging if it was, like, where, like, you know... I assure you, it's not the same unit. They're not facing the same battalions over and over again, right?
I have a shorter word for that, which is losing. They are losing. And I mean, I get what you're saying, and I do think that, unfortunately, there's quite a lot of blood that remains to be spilled before this is over. But this is good, because this is a testable prediction, and so we'll have to see, but I think first of all, I certainly agree that there seems to be everybody, you, me, and the Russians and the Ukrainians seem to all agree that the current rate of the loss of territory is more or less acceptable. Acceptable in the sense of like it's a kind of dynamic equilibrium. The problem is, like, dynamic equilibria can change and change rapidly based on the inputs. And they're mobilizing some number of people, and who knows, maybe they'll manage to get the two Patriot systems that Zelensky was demanding, and that will shoot down some number of Russian missiles and maybe even planes before it is inevitably kindled, destroyed by a hypersonic Russian missile, and then what? The rate of change can be altered, can be made, you know, depending on the amount of lives that Ukraine is willing to throw into this wood chipper, or the Jews in charge of Ukraine are willing to, the number of goyim that the Jews are willing to do this to in Ukraine. You can twiddle with that rate of change, but it's going to be like negative for Ukraine and positive for Russia.
Just to cut you the chase. Do you have you said you had a Tesla prediction you want to put down? Like you want to put like X city falls by X date kind of thing? Or?
I don't know about particular cities, but I think we're going to see, yes, I think we are going to see these kind of slow but steady gains for probably another 2 months or so, 6 to 8 weeks, something like that. And then I think we're going to see not a total collapse, but a rapid deterioration in the position of the Ukrainian military, forcing them to fall back to some kind of natural defensive boundary, probably the Volga River and the Slovyansk-Kramatorsk agglomeration. Basically, I think there's going to be a mini breakout. I think it's going to be like we're already. I think functionally there already is a breakout. It's just so small scale. It's at such a small scale compared to the closest like immediate analog, which is the Second World War, that it's like hard to see. And then that it because also it's so small that it become in some ways it's easier to like plug the gaps because like the marginal utility of a single additional body is greater than it was in the Second World War, but by a lot even. But yeah, I think the Ukrainians have a huge, like they are actually starting to run out of bodies. They just passed, you know, talk about not getting news cucked. It's been officially ratified, the new mobilization law. That's a move of desperation. I don't know how effective it's going to be. My guess is it's not going to be particularly effective for a whole lot of reasons. And then you combine that with, I am assuming, I was thinking about this actually, because like, okay, you were saying, you know, skeptically about the number of guys in the Northern Forest. And then Armchair Warlord made a point, which I hadn't like fully like thought through, but yeah, you don't need those guys to be immediately staged, at least not right away. They can be in Belgorod, they can be in Kursk, they can be in Moscow or St. Petersburg. And then if it becomes a question of, if you know in advance, we're going to take approximately, whatever, 500 meters along a 60 kilometer wide front per day, and we can continue that more or less indefinitely, as you seem to have just admitted, then it's a very, because like the problem with staging guys, like you need to have guys, you know, increasingly close by, and it can be really tough to get the plug reserves where you need them, especially on offense, right? And defender has a lot of strategic advantages in terms of getting reserves in places where they're going to be effective. If you can plan on like, okay, I'm going to be 10 kilometers from here in 2 weeks, give or take, then you can start the process of moving guys to the front, like on a rolling 2 week basis. And that becomes, it becomes very, very effective very quickly to like plug manpower into gaps. And there are tons of gaps, and some of them have been closed off, some more closed off than others. And yes, urban agglomerations present, they're sort of inherently just sort of makeshift fortifications, because there's like rock that you can hide behind, even if it gets bombed. But in the absence of a coherent air defense net, there is no response in the offing to the FAB problem. There just isn't. Like there's no, Ukraine would need 100 F-16s and 100 Patriot systems and enough missiles for both of those systems, you know, produced 24/7, 365 by factories that don't exist and aren't producing those munitions, even if the platforms existed, which they don't, because they also need to be manufactured. And they, I guess the F-16s yeah. exist.
I actually was thinking about this, whereas I think one of the reasons F-16s aren't seeing wide deployment into the conflict is the inability of the West to, like,
to put missiles to, on put the, yes, put yes, missiles like on the at, airframes. Yeah.
Yes. They were running out of missiles throughout. I mean, the F-16s were running out of missiles in every major deployment they've ever had, because they're good at firing a lot of them, right? Like, that's a problem, right? Where you're the F-16s are very good at, like, ground attack roles, so they eat up missiles like you wouldn't believe, right? So, you know, there's not a war that's happened, like, even, like, the Libya thing, they were running out of bombs. Like, running out of JDAMs when you widely deploy F-16s is, like, that thing that just happens, you know? You can't really avoid it.
Yeah, no, so, and this, which speaks, again, to the overall, like...
Also, there's this other country that also uses a lot of JDAMs.
Yeah, right. And F-16s, you know, Israel needs F-16s, Israel needs air defense, Israel needs bombs and missiles. For their war, they're also losing. So yeah, I don't know. It's definitely so far, the conservative position would have never been wrong in the Russian Ukraine. You know, anyone, not just myself, sort of expecting or predicting or hoping for some kind of big arrows on a map has been very severely let down and disabused of that notion. But I think we're actually now at a point. I think we are. If we're not there right now, we are rapidly approaching it. I think within certainly the next year, of an inflection point where the rates of change diverge.
So I think you're very right. I thought you were going to go longer, like on the prediction. I think 2 months is when you're going to the advances in Donetsk will stop. Although I have a different reason than like a key defensive line being retreated to or whatever. So the problem with... I mentioned they're doing this thing with the parent... Because a parent brigade is sending a single battalion and a frontline assault to, you know, take losses that are to end ground, and then it's reinforced with the parent brigade, right? The problem with that is it's very logistically intensive, because effectively you are costing yourself a brigade of logistics for a battalion worth of attack, right?
Sure.
And that's fine when you're attacking out of your very well-developed defensive lines from the Sorokin line, right? But once you advance out of those, like, logistics nets, it's going to get more constrained, and you have to shift gears in some way, you know?
Well, how, where
you
keep... But how... I mean, okay, that's a good argument for not necessarily expecting all that much out of the Southern Front, maybe, but I don't... I'm not... I could be wrong. I don't believe that the Russian, like, the Donetsk and Luhansk People Republic militias had particularly well-developed... I'm sure they had some, you know, trenches and defensive works or whatever, but, like, the big concrete fortifications and the really, really tough nuts to crack, my understanding is they were all on the other side of that line in large part because...
Well, I'm not referring to the fortifications that... Okay. I'm talking about, like, the logistics hubs. It's like,
okay,
the,
sure, yeah.
The, right, railways, sure. The railways that they've improved, yeah, yeah, and sure. Or built in,
and
in
built,
the past.
Yeah, they built in, like, in connecting Mariupol to Crimea, essentially. Yeah, it's like, that's all new. And it's... Yeah. No, okay, so then maybe we're on... So why do you... So you think they're going to...
I think the Russians will run out of gas, effectively, in terms of, like, how much they can reinforce these brigades and resupply them, in the, because they're fighting in a non logistically efficient manner, which would be like, ideally the doctrinal pre-war doctrine would be like, this brigade does brigade actions till it's degraded, a fresh brigade comes and leapfrogs it, right? And that brigade falls back
That's what I was essentially...
What they're doing, yes, is they're keeping single brigades in the fight, but only attacking with, like, a single battalion, and they keep pushing that one up. And the thing is, the front that this brigade is attacking along is very small. There's a front, like, actual frontage of the unit, right? They're covering a battalion as a frontage, so you have a ton of these brigades doing this, right, to find the weak point. But that means you effectively have, like, triple supply demands that you would normally have, which, as they get past these, like, well-developed logistics hubs, you're 20 more kilometers forward, then you're bringing stuff that much further under fire, that it's not quite, like, every 20 kilometers you gain, you're under that much more pressure, and it's hard to just keep that level where they'll have to return to a more traditional mode of how they were doing things. But like it's harder to reinforce a battalion than it is to replace, or a brigade than it is to replace it, right? Reinforcement is a pain in the ass because people need specific things, right? Like you need a specific. We lost a lot of X today, right? We need X in our order, whereas you just pull back and are replaced by a full strength thing is much easier. And I think they'll have to start doing that, or that's also like much more manpower intensive in terms of like actually committing soldiers because you have to be rotating people off. Like you're throwing a lot of a spoke in the wheel of their battle rhythm when you start doing that. Also, these units that have developed these kind of like parent brigade battalion assault tactics are probably the best units in the Russian military right now, just by weight of experience and things. And without that, I don't know if you can just pull in one of these green brigades to replace that. You know, that's these units fought on the defense for a long time and have basically developed offensive tactics that seem to be very organic to them, right? Things like the turtle tanks, like whether a green brigade can come in and do this or just do it at the same rate is very questionable to me. Also, these guys will just run to take losses that they can't replace at a certain point, right? Like at a certain point a brigade is all replacements and it's no longer the brigade it was, right? Like it's a different thing and it's maybe it's as good, maybe it's not. They're in a similar boat as the Israelis, right, where they have very high level units like Israel's Golani in the north, but like you can't run them forever, right? You have to give these guys a break at some point. And they're running at a much higher tempo fighting conventional war than Golani is in the north. So I think like you are going to risk cracking your. Also, these are army regular brigades. They're not elite. They're not these infantry heavy things like the VDV or the Marines, who are currently not doing much, right? The VDV and the Marines. Well, there's a couple of VDV brigades that are just playing as brigades right now, but I think you will see a point where these regular formations are whittled down or run out of gas or lose their tempo for one of these numbers of reasons, and you see like Russian Marines come in to kind of stabilize things, and Akhmat is coming back. You're seeing like certain units coming back that are higher, like light infantry, more focused brigades that will just hold ground to like they will find a new piece of the front that the Russians find acceptable, and then reinforce that with like more defensively minded troops.
Yeah, well, that's okay, that's cool. Then we'll have to see. We will. I'm sure there will be more developments to discuss in the near future. I had hoped to get into some of the operational nitty gritty, but I think that's actually probably a pretty good place to leave it. Because yeah, as you say, I mean, the situation in some ways, like. If you care about the operational nitty gritty, you know, there are YouTube channels for that. I guess I enjoy, I've been, DPA, we've mentioned Willie OAM and Military Summary. I wouldn't watch all of them every day, but, yeah, to get a sense of, and they also kind of run the spectrum of like lightly pro Ukraine to pretty neutral to, pro Russia, but not like a dick about it. Yeah, it's there's stuff happening, which is I guess in the background of my analysis and predictions is that I guess that's not in question. The question is really what happens next, and we'll have to wait and see. Time will tell. So yeah, was there anything else? Did you want to?
Nope. Good trip.
Yeah. Take care and stay safe, everybody.
After dark, hits of morphine in the cat.